Welcome to the Alliance Party After Dark, a podcast for the politically aware brought to you by the Alliance Party. The interview in this podcast was originally recorded on September 5, 2019. My name is Dan Schaefer, producer of the Alliance Party After Dark, and this episode is the third in a four-part series where our moderator, M. Lloyd Johnson, discusses some very important topics with the national chair of the Alliance Party, Mr. Jim Rex. As we've mentioned in previous podcasts in this series, Jim Rex has a solid background in politics. He co-founded and chaired the American Party of South Carolina, and he was the last Democrat to win a statewide election in South Carolina when elected as the 16th State Superintendent of Education in 2006. Education is a big part of Jim's life. He earned a PhD in curriculum and instruction from the University of Toledo. Though he began his career as a high school English teacher and football coach, he soon worked his way up to become the Dean of Education at Winthrop University and at Coastal Carolina University, and later he served as president of Columbia College in South Carolina. We had so many questions for Jim, and our discussion lasted nearly 2 hours, so we broke everything up into four episodes of about a half hour each. You're listening to the third in the series. In previous installments of this series, we talked about a variety of topics, including unemployment, the economy, healthcare, immigration, terrorism, domestic gun violence, and racism. We'll continue now, starting off with a very important topic these days, how to reconcile differences between people while keeping passion and energy alive. Hey, if you're driving your car while listening to this podcast, make sure you buckle up, keep your eyes on the road, and get ready for a fascinating ride as we get the straight scoop from a leader of one of America's fastest growing political parties. And now, M. Lloyd Johnson continues our interview with Jim Rex.
When you're encouraging your candidates to be civil and encourage civility, you have the challenge of drumming up passion. So when you're in the middle, how do you, or and when I'm saying in the middle, when you're trying to get two sides to come to an agreement, how do you drive up passion? How do you drive up energy when so much of the energy that we've seen in politics in the past centuries of its existence have been divisive and polarized? How do we switch that energy and really just get people focused on the importance of coming together to some sort of agreement? Isn't there a whole challenge of getting a mass of Americans to say, hey, let's try to get along and come up with a solution together where we all compromise a little bit and work for the greater good and serenity of people as a whole rather than of a small group of people?
Well, that's a great question. You know, there's negative passion and there's positive passion. And our politicians, for the most part, rely on negative passion. You know, the people you are against, the other side, you know, the other party, whatever it is. Positive passion, I think, can be generated if you have elected officials who say to their constituents, look, you may disagree on how to solve this problem, but disagreement's not going to get us anywhere. It may get me reelected, but it's not going to get us anywhere in terms of coming up with a solution that'll make your lives better, your community better, your state better, your nation better. So I'm going to tell you as your elected official, if you'll work with me, I'll work with you, and let's find some solutions that maybe aren't perfection, but they're a movement in the right direction. It will improve the situation. And I guarantee you that as your elected official, I will support that solution. I will introduce legislation if necessary. And I don't care what my party says or my party's position. My job is to make your life better and to implement the solutions that you and I come up with. So I'm not in the middle. I'm not in between the party and you trying to take some safe position to get reelected. Instead, I'm here to tell you that if you'll work with me and we can find some areas of agreement, I'll implement that within the next 48 hours if need be. That's how I think you can generate positive passion. Finally, have some elected officials that will do something, that will actually make something happen that can move the ball forward, even if it doesn't satisfy everyone totally. Right now, I think most Americans believe that nothing will get done, that politicians will talk a good game, but do very little. And you know, how does that generate positive passion? It doesn't. It generates negative passion. So you start looking around for scapegoats. We can't get anything done and my life gets worse and I can't get anything out of my politician. I'm going to find somebody else to blame. And it's usually another group or the other side or the other tribe that that I'm convinced is the problem.
So how do you handle, and I'm going to give some examples, how do you handle the more controversial topics where your constituency might be pretty divided? An example would be abortion. Another example would be the war on drugs or the death penalty. And just as an example to really make the question a little bit more challenging, the Innocence Project, which has saved innocent people from execution through DNA exoneration, has taken an issue which used to be a simple yay or nay to let's really examine what actually happened scenario and make sure we're absolutely certain one way or the other, not just this person did it. They get executed because that's the right thing to do versus the government shouldn't be doing this because it's wrong to execute anybody. It's more of a let's make sure we've actually executed innocent people in the past. How do we prevent that? So how do we handle these types of controversial topics where the two sides are barely listening to each other? How do we get them to listen and say, and see, oh, okay, here's the other side of this. Here's what I'm missing. What do we do to create a bridge on controversial topics?
Right. It's certainly not easy. But what I think we're talking about is a new definition that we need desperately in this country of what a public servant is, an elected public servant. Is it somebody who takes sides on positions based on ideology, and in most cases, they take the side that will get them elected and reelected, not necessarily, you know, what's right or what makes sense. Or do we want to start electing people who are facilitators of compromise and solutions and improvement? We desperately need the latter. We desperately need to minimize or get rid of the former. In order to have people who are courageous enough to play that facilitator role, they're going to have to be willing to risk upsetting people in the process and maybe not even getting reelected, not catering to their base, which would, you know, if you can get 1% of the vote that your opponent doesn't get and you make that percentage happy and the other percentage miserable, you don't care if your only objective is to get reelected. If you're only in office for a certain number of years and your job is to make things better and improve them, you're willing to work with the entire group and maybe satisfy the majority in both groups and a minority in both groups, leave those people dissatisfied, but come up with solutions and move things forward. So we're going to need people who are not only facilitators of finding solutions and consensus and compromise, but people who are willing to risk not getting reelected because of how difficult and sometimes messy that process is. I think there are always ways to do that. Sometimes it takes particularly gifted people to do it, but if they're respected and they're honest and they tell the truth and they're authentic, the majority of their constituents will eventually listen to them. And so you mentioned capital punishment, Lloyd. Well, you just came up with, I think, a good middle ground to start with. And that is whether you're for it or against it, we could all agree that DNA testing should be mandatory before any sentence is passed. We should do everything possible to make sure we know for certain whether the person is innocent or guilty. And if there's any glimmer of doubt as to their guilt, then maybe you can argue they should be imprisoned while we continue to, you know, try to figure all that out. But certainly it should be executed. That's a hard thing to recover from. You know, the same thing with abortion. I think there can be discussions about, yes, all life is precious. The mother's life is precious, and the infant's life is precious. If push comes to shove, which sometimes happens because of the life of the mother and medical contingencies and risks, if you have to choose, and in life sometimes we have to choose, is one life more precious than the other? Let's talk about it. If it's your mother or your wife, and at this point yet an anonymous infant, and one of them has to die, which one of those lives would you choose to save? I don't know what the answer to that is, but that question is one that you ought to have people seriously and sympathetically discuss with one another. What does that really mean in terms of this whole debate about abortion? And what do we really mean about the value of life? And is some life more precious than others under certain circumstances? And when those tough decisions have to be made, who should make them? Should the government make them? Should a political party make them, make based on ideology? Or should the individual impacted by it make it? Here again, I don't want to say what I think personally, but if I'm asked, I'll tell people, and we want our candidates to do that, what I think personally about those questions. But more importantly, can I find areas of agreement among my constituents and promise them that I'll move on legislation to implement those areas of agreement? That's what I think we can start getting from our elected officials if we'll just demand it and start electing those kinds of people instead of the combatants that we're getting now that are using those issues as political footballs.
That was a topic I was just going to almost dodge completely. But just on that note, and I'd like your feedback. I knew a young woman who had a few abortions. And some people might say, hey, yeah, that's great. She got to choose. However, what she told me was all of those abortions were because her boyfriend had pressured her into it. And there was no one to ask her or consult her or see what she really wanted to do because the assumption was just it was her choice. So are there areas that neither side is looking at or that both sides are looking at limitedly that we could start discussing with each other?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I can't put myself in someone else's skin, and I can't pretend to know what it would be like to be a woman in America right now who has all of the rights and privileges of a man except during a 9-month period in her life, or maybe multiple 9-month periods in her life, when she is told that she does not have total autonomy and control over her own body. I can't imagine what that would be like if somebody told me as a male that there would be certain periods of time in my life, periods of time that maybe I have control over and maybe I don't, when I lose that autonomy over what I can do with my own body. So I think we need to talk to one another and listen to one another sensitively about what those kinds of decisions really look like in real life. And I think most people who believe a woman should have the right to choose would agree that the woman who's doing the choosing should have all of the information and all of the options available at her disposal before she makes that decision. She shouldn't be pressured into that decision by, in this case, a husband or a boyfriend. She also shouldn't be pressured into that decision by some governmental unit or some political party or some ideology group.
Right.
She should have, you know, the full array of options and explanations in front of her. Now, some of this goes back to our earlier discussion about health care. You know, if we had a sophisticated, affordable, accessible health care system that provided women that information, including prevention, you know, birth control, so we don't have a lot of unwanted pregnancies, that would go a long way towards solving some of these problems. But these are really difficult personal problems and questions, and I don't think we ought to be demeaning one another and accusing one of others of being immoral or insensitive just because people have different opinions about it. We need to have open, sensitive discussions. And that's what I want my elected official to do that I employ, you know, for my district, my Congress, my State House, my Senate. when we have those kinds of issues where there are legitimate differences of opinion, please don't turn it into a political football. Don't use it for political advantage. Help us talk to one another and figure out some humane, reasonable approaches to find some common ground.
That's something that's really missing from our political dialogue. One thing that maybe I should ask, there's obviously a stress on these football issues, and they're used to drive up passion. But what about local issues? How much are they being neglected, or how much can they be used? So these football issues that might not relate don't hog up the attention. Like there's the example of, are you going to ask a mayor whether they are pro-life or pro-choice? Is that really have anything to do with their arena? So is there a certain amount of emphasis that maybe could go towards local issues that we're missing from our political dialogue?
Yes, and in many cases, the local issues are more important to the day-to-day quality of a citizen's life than what the national network news is covering in terms of what's happening in Washington, D.C. You know, most Americans drive on roads or see other forms of infrastructure that are badly, badly in need of repair. Many times, that's a local issue. We talked briefly about education earlier. That's a state issue in large part. And so if you have lousy public schools, deteriorating schools, buildings, poorly trained or poorly compensated teachers, teacher shortages, if you have children or grandchildren, that impacts your life on a daily basis as well as their future. You need to be paying attention to that. Your local legislator, your local mayor, your school board member isn't going to make any decisions about abortion or immigration policy. And so if they're bringing that up as part of their campaign, they're playing you as for a sucker. They're trying to inflame those passions you talked about earlier, Lloyd, that have absolutely nothing to do with their role as an elected official. They're just trying to get you to vote for them or against their opponent based upon a phony issue. So local issues are important, and we ought to challenge people who are running for office who are trying to use issues that they know full well they're never going to have to deal with or vote on.
You've been listening to an interview with Jim Rex, the national chair of the Alliance Party. We will return after a short break.
The two-party system that we've got is broken.
The choices are awful. All we see is lies, cheating, deceit.
You could say it about both parties. Neither one really stands for anything except acquiring and exercising power.
The idea was to give the power to the people, or the people who've given the power away. And that's where the system broke.
Government and our political system was designed to be malleable, you know, not rigid, not ossified, not always gridlocked.
Absolute power does corrupt, absolutely, and that's why the founders set the system up to avoid having concentrated power in the executive and in the national branch.
The founding documents are the best, it's the best government so far that we've come up with. We're just not doing it.
You know, it's tribalism, basically. If you're not on my tribe, then you're a bad person. You could say the sky is blue, and I'm going to say, no, it's green.
I think it's right out of a 1930s era playbook where if you can divide people, make them feel like something's being taken from them, probably pays well for them to make sure that everybody's divided, because in essence, it keeps them in office, it keeps them in power, it keeps them employed.
The amount of money that's involved in politics, it is crazy.
And Obama's a smart guy, but not even he could, he wasn't going to do it either. And I was like, okay, that's it. If he can't do it, it's not going to happen, because that's when I knew that the lobbyists and the corporate interests, the outside private interests that really have a hand in making sure that our political system doesn't work, I knew that they had won. And I said, okay, third party is the way to go.
What I think we're trying to do here is to make systemic change. Yeah, we need the right people, but there's not any one person, any one charismatic personality that's going to bring about the change that we so desperately need in this country.
Our biggest goals are election reform.
Knock down those barriers that have been built in the ballot access game by the state governments.
Fixing the dark money.
Getting good health care out there.
We need more women, we need more minorities, we need more occupations and backgrounds.
We don't have set paradigms and beliefs. We just want to solve problems. So we're open books, we're data sensitive, we want data, and we want to solve solutions that help the most people.
Let's forget about where we disagree. Let's start with where do we agree.
Let facts be facts and let truth be truth and afford people the opportunity to go and find the information they need.
We require term limits of all of our candidates.
Now, if you have more choices and competition, just like any free market enterprise, competition is going to give you a better product.
Focus on innovation and really learning on a local level.
Free press and educating people in an unbiased way.
Protecting and controlling the deficit.
With respect and courtesy.
Honesty through transparency.
Openness and transparency.
Transparency. I think that's incredibly important in a number of areas, but especially in finances, so that voters can connect the dots.
We want to leave this place in a better condition than we left it for the next generations, pure and simple. Not just my children, all our American kids.
We need to educate every single individual in this country, so every individual has tools they need to succeed in life.
Ultimately, that's what we're doing this for, what we can help the American people be. Not what we say they can be, but what they want to be, and we'll get our party to that point.
We're supposed to help each other rise up, enlighten each other, and start by being civil and respecting other people's opinions.
There's nobody left. We have to do it.
There's right and there's wrong. Nobody owns it. You know, JFK, I believe, was quoted as saying something to the effect of, we don't need to look for the Republican answer or the Democratic answer. We need to look for the correct answer. And that's the types of conversations we're not having. As a people, are we doing what we should be doing?
We're back. We're listening to an interview between our moderator, M. Lloyd Johnson, and Jim Rex, the national chair of the Alliance Party. Let's continue the discussion, starting out with foreign policy and human rights.
So moving to another topic, foreign policy, a loaded topic. We have countries like North Korea and Russia that want to get along with us, but they're dictatorships, and their desire to get along with us might not have to do with our best interests at all. But we also have dictatorships that we get along with very well. We get along well with Saudi Arabia. We get along well with Turkey that has imprisoned several journalists. Saudi Arabia, there was that problem of the journalist Khashoggi being assassinated, which came from a very high level. We also have friction with China, and that's both over money manipulation and human rights concerns. There's reports of the detention camps up north, and now much more in the limelight currently are the protests coming from Hong Kong and the police abuses that are reported. Now, obviously, what's happening there is not happening here, but how should we handle our relationships with human rights violating dictatorships? What can we do, and how far should we go? We have this process that we use called sanctions. Is that a viable working solution? And obviously your answer is going to be different than a lot of candidates' answers, because it's just going to be something where our federal candidates are going to have their own takes. But what is a good way to approach this, a good, reasonable, sensible way to approach this?
Well, first of all, it would be great if we had a well-articulated national policy that explains how we will deal with what you just described. We don't. We deal with these different countries, these different regimes, these different approaches to governance on an ad hoc basis. And in most cases, it has to do with our own special interests. Sometimes those special interests have to do with national security issues. And sometimes, frankly, they have to do purely with economic issues. Sometimes they're driven by international corporations and their interests more than they're driven by what's best for the nation, for our country. So we ought to have a well-articulated, visible, transparent policy for how we deal with the kinds of nations that you just described. I think as a generalization, and this is purely a generalization because there's different degrees of, of human rights violations and some of the other things you mentioned. I think in almost every case, we ought to have open communications with these other nations, even if, they're dictators and there's bad things happening. We should have open communications because in the long run, that may be the best way to help change some of the dynamics in those countries. And in some cases, I think we should also have commerce. We ought to have clearly articulated rules of engagement, but we ought to have commerce agreements and arrangements with nations that have different forms of governance and government than we do, even if it's something we don't necessarily agree with. One thing's for sure, if there's a dictatorship or human rights violations, our national leaders should not be praising the leaders of those nations. We should not be giving any aid or comfort to the leaders of those nations who are inflicting that kind of damage on their own people. And as you know, in recent times, we've had praise heaped on, yeah, on the leaders of countries that in the past we never would have done with that. I think the other thing in general, and this is in general, I don't think the United States should be engaged in regime change. I don't think it's our right to go in and through military intervention, covert or overt, replace a regime. We've done that in the past. We probably have done it too many times. And in some cases, the replacement has turned out to be worse than the original regime that we replaced. I think that's up to the people in that country. We can try to influence them. We can try to educate them. We can try to show contrast. And now with the internet and all kinds of ways to communicate worldwide, I think people in other countries can look with envy at freer economies and freer forms of government and want to emulate them. I think that's a legitimate way to try to influence these other nations, but not through military power. I just don't think that the United States can be the policeman of the world in terms of what's right and what's correct for other nations. So, that's not a very concise foreign policy, but I think something along those lines could be hammered out and utilized by our administration when it comes to foreign relations. And I think we could come up with something that most Americans would agree with.
Yeah, very good. You're right. It's something that we haven't hammered out. Now, here's another question, and I'll circle back actually to this just because, even though they're not directly related, just because I can use it to illustrate it. Personal attacks against politicians, that's something that is frowned upon in the Alliance Party. So, where would the line be? And just as an example, if a politician for a federal level has an immediate family member, like maybe a brother, a wife or husband, daughter, son-in-law, who has a strong financial relationship involving a controversial foreign government, could this be brought up? Does it need to be avoided? If that foreign government is controversial in a way that relates to our national security, would that be something that's a personal attack? What's the difference between a personal attack and a policy attack, and where could they be confused?
Well, that's a difficult question because there's a big gray area there, especially the example you gave in terms of relatives or members of the family, because as I think most of your listeners would agree, sometimes we know about and support and are aware of what, a relative is doing, a child, a spouse, and sometimes we're not. So I would think any behavior that deals with that candidate or that elected official's ability to legislate or govern, any behavior that has a direct relationship to that. So if the person is actually involved with a foreign nation and benefiting from that involvement with that nation, or has a family member who's doing that with their knowledge, and support, and that compromises their ability to do what's in the best interest of our country, if this is a federal position, for example. I think that's a legitimate issue. That's not a personal attack. Anytime an elected official lies or misstates the facts, I think that's a legitimate issue. I think you can attack them, quote unquote, or at least point out the inaccuracy of their statements. That's not a personal attack. That's a legitimate point that can be made during a debate or during a campaign. So there's always going to be a gray area. I think it comes down to the ability of that person to govern and or legislate, depending on the office they're running for, whether they have any obvious conflicts of interest that would mean that they would not be looking out for the best interests of their constituents. That's legitimate. But personal attacks, you know, have to do with things like maybe they've been married before and they've been divorced or something. That has nothing to do with their ability to govern. So, you know, when you go after those kinds of things, or if you make racial slurs, or whether you say it directly or indirectly, covertly or overtly, about their background or their origins, that sort of thing, that's what we do not want our candidates to engage in. We want them to deal with the issues, and we want them to be truthful about the facts. And when their opponents are not dealing with the issues or also truthful with the facts, we want them to call them out on it.
So I'll go ahead and ask a follow-up on that. It might be self-evident, and it might be something that, I wouldn't want to say is a gray area. But I'll just say, in light of the Me Too movement, if a politician has serious allegations of sexual misconduct to a degree of assault, maybe a number of allegations or a certain settlement amount, is it fair to bring those into question? Should candidates just rely solely on the media to handle that? Is that something where the function of the office might be in question more than it being a personal attack? How do we address the Me Too movement as it relates to judging candidates? And how do we refrain from going to the area of personal attacks on a slippery slope of maybe 20 years ago someone made a lewd comment? Where would we keep that from being a personal attack, but yet be realistic about, okay, this is serious enough?
Well, that's a great question, Lloyd. If you've had a bunch of them tonight, you know, our mores change over time as a society, and what was acceptable in the past may not be acceptable any longer today. And that goes back to your constituents again, and you're an elected official. Now, one of the things that I think most Americans still support is that you're guilty until proven innocent in this country. And so allegations in and of themselves are probably not legitimate areas for candidates to engage in. In other words, a candidate should use an allegation as proof of guilt if an opponent has been accused of something, whether it's sexual or anything else. I do think, though, if you have multiple allegations from multiple women, it's a legitimate question that you could ask a candidate to address, not imply that they're guilty, but just to ask them in the spirit of, you know, transparency, your constituents and I, as your opponent, need to hear your explanation or your defense for these multiple allegations. But one allegation, I would stay away from it. Anybody can accuse anybody of anything at any given time. And
that's
if
true.
We allow politicians to use that and assume that that's an indication of guilt, that's dirty politics. That's negative politics. And we don't want our candidates to get embroiled in that.
As the Alliance Party, would you say, are you never Trumpers? If not, why would you support a party you don't want to win? Are people rejecting Trump on almost every point just to reject him? Or has he really been so bad we need to reject just about everything he does?
Well, first of all, Lloyd, the Alliance Party is not about Donald Trump. The Alliance Party began long before Donald Trump was president or even ran for president. You know, we're not never Trumpers, never Clintons, or never anything. What we are is never the duopoly. I mean, we have a system that doesn't work, and it's a system that was created and is perpetuated by the two parties. These are these private organizations that have taken over our democracy. They're not mentioned in the Constitution. Most of the founding fathers were against the two-party system, and yet here we are in 2019 in gridlock, not dealing with our problems, divided as a nation because of what these two parties have done. And they have given us poor leadership, election cycle after election cycle, not just in the presidency, but in our local state legislatures and in our Congress, that has kept us from solving the problems we have as a nation. So this is not about an individual, Donald Trump or anybody else. It's about a system that allows us to get presidents and U.S. senators and congressmen who do not do what's in the best interests of America. And so, you know, we don't reject any individual for everything they do. You know, bad people do good things and good people do bad things. And that's true of elected officials as well as the rest of us. This is about changing a system, not replacing an individual.
We recently pulled out of the Paris Accords. With big nations like China and India still being significant polluters, did the Paris Accords have a significant impact? And is our environment a significant issue that's being overlooked? Are there certain studies, scientific studies on climate change that are just being ignored?
Well, they're being ignored by the politicians in both parties to a large extent. And it's a critical problem. In fact, it may be an existential problem. And I think more and more people are beginning to view it that way, that it may have risen to the top of the list in terms of any kind of intergenerational responsibility. If we feel we have any responsibility to our children or our grandchildren or the generations beyond them, then certainly we need to start thinking about how we take care of this planet. And we are definitely giving our children and grandchildren a planet that is less capable of sustaining the quality of life that we have become accustomed to than that they will have. So, I mean, we are ignoring it politically. There are lots of scientists who are not ignoring it. There are lots of young people who are not ignoring it in countries around the world. And I think it's going to become increasingly a dominant issue in American politics as well as in international politics. Now, whether or not the Paris Accords had brought about any meaningful change or improvement yet, if it has, it's been very minimal. You know, how do you get billions of people to change their behaviors across all these countries, especially when we know these behaviors are doing, in some cases, not only serious damage, but perhaps even irreparable damage to the planet and the climate we all rely on. This comes back to politics, but this is an even bigger issue than some of the others we've discussed in this program, because you're dealing with the leaders in lots of other countries, including some of the ones that don't function very well, like the question you just asked me about dictatorships and despots. So how do you do that? I think one way is for us to lead by example. I think the United States has always been a beacon for many people in the world. One of the reasons democracy spread across the planet is because of this country and the exceptional example we provided for people around the world who wanted to emulate us, who wanted to have the kind of quality of life we have. What if we also had as goals to have, as a nation, the cleanest water, the cleanest air, the best conserved wildlife? You know, what if we had as a goal to have the healthiest population, to have the highest longevity, the average longevity rate of any nation? What if we actually tried to be the best at the things that matter and then led by example to the other countries who we could show how to do that because we did it? That may be a better way than just having accords. We ought to start here at home and show that we can solve these problems and lead the way for other nations to follow suit.
We've been listening to M. Lloyd Johnson's interview with Jim Rex, the national chair of the Alliance Party. Unfortunately, we're out of time for this episode. Please stay tuned to the Alliance Party website for subsequent episodes in this interview series. Or, better yet, subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Google, or Spotify. Every week, we will bring you more interesting topics from the Alliance Party. All content for this podcast is copyright the Alliance Party. Views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Alliance Party. This podcast is a production of the Alliance Party, a decades-long movement of fiscally conservative, moderate, accountable, and reasoned independents, former Democrats, former Republicans, and alienated voters who demand that our elected officials work in the spirit of nonpartisanship for all constituents and provide a better future for our country. This podcast was made possible by your donations to the Alliance Party. If you'd like to help sponsor this podcast directly, get in touch with us through our website at theallianceparty.com. If you'd like to join the Alliance Party, visit our website at theallianceparty.com. Drop in, see what we're all about, and get involved. Volunteer your time, make a donation, submit an article or blog, or run for office. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Dan Schaefer, producer of the Alliance Party After Dark, and on behalf of our moderator, M. Lloyd Johnson, and everyone at the Alliance Party, have a wonderful evening, a great week ahead, and we hope you drop in for our next show. Be safe and be aware.